Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. When I'm drinking a nice cold glass of water, or maybe I'm eating a salad, I'm assuming that what I'm eating is safe. It's fine. Not poisoned. Chances are nobody is plotting to intentionally poison me. But what about hidden poisons, traces of it that might be lurking all around me? Just this weekend, I was swimming in a river. It felt really refreshing. But then afterwards, I thought, how clean is that water? On today's show, we track down poison in our food, in our environment, even in some of our medical treatments. A poisonous plant killing animals out west. A woman finding comfort in an ancient ritual after a medical treatment that felt like poison. And a researcher who intentionally poisoned people to make food safer for the rest of us. Our first story takes us to a tiny community in Alabama where residents have been fighting what they say is a poison that's been killing their way of life. First, they complained to the local government. Nothing changed. They went to the state and finally the federal government. Still, they got nowhere. Irina Zhorov reports.
Red dirt colors the landscape beyond the rolling blacktop that winds through Asher Spar Smith, a rural community in Tallapoosa County, central Alabama. Forest mutes out modern-day commotion. Annie Keller has lived here for 65 years, but in the last few decades, the place has changed on her.
I can't sit on my porch no more, and I love to sit on my porch. It smells so bad, I can't.
She says the stench gets worse on warm days and unbearable in the summertime.
So I usually put a mask on my face when I come out to cut grass. Man, it's rough. It's really rough. And I'm scared to put anything in the ground. I wanted to plant a garden. I ain't planted a garden in over 15 years now. I'm scared.
She closed up her well and now uses the municipal water supply. She took her clothesline down.
I used to hang my clothes on them old fashioned. Can't hang them out. The last time I hung them out, they stunk so bad I had to wash them twice to get that odor out of them. And I know then something was serious. I said, something is wrong. These clothes stink. They're like somebody had thrown something on them dead. I'm saying, what is this? And a lot of them I throwed away, especially my sheets and stuff. I throwed them away.
She's telling me all this in her front yard. A couple of neighbors are also there. Someone mentions that he's gotten up some mornings to find vultures sitting all over his house, his mother's house, the trees. The culprit of all this trouble? Annie leans on her cane, lifts her hand up, and points her finger east.
Go to the end of this road and make the left. There it is. Might be a mile, yeah.
Down that road sits the Stone's Throw Landfill, a municipal solid waste disposal site, a dump. Ron Smith, another local, took me to see it.
It started out as a dump site for yard refuse, brush, tree limbs, things like that.
In 1993, the small site closed. That same year, Alabama adopted new laws regulating landfills. Before the laws, there were 300 dumps in Alabama, but now around 30 operate, which of course means they're bigger. In 1999, the owners wanted to reopen as a larger municipal dump, taking in all sorts of trash.
They got a permit. That's when the trouble really started for us.
We drive past ponds of muddy water and heavy machinery moving up a mountain of ruddy soil. In this tiny bucolic settlement tucked into forest land, it's shocking to see. From Ron's house, the hump of dirt peeks through the trees.
Stop here and cut it off.
Locals resisted this expansion. Ron's mother, Ann, spearheaded the efforts. We stopped by to see her. Ann's house is overflowing with stuff.
The landfill, huh?
Photos of her family jostle for room on the walls, piles of paper grow precariously from surfaces, and books, so many books, line her generous library. She's lived in this house, on land gifted to her for her wedding, for more than 60 years.
And I'm getting ready to celebrate my 88th birthday.
She says she knew from the start the reopened landfill would be a problem.
I was concerned about health. And I was also concerned about the value of land.
Ann's community is mostly African American in a mostly white county. It's a low-income area, but many here have owned their land for generations. Their ancestors acquired it at the first taste of freedom. Phyllis Gosa, who worked with Ann against the landfill, says she can trace her family to Tallapoosa County, starting with the 1870 census. Owning their own acres kept the family from being chained to other people's land.
If you did not have your own property through probably the 1960s, many people lived on farms and were, if not slaves, they were sharecroppers. And that was as bad as, because you really didn't have freedom. You were controlled by your ties to the farm.
Now the land carries the weight of heritage as well. Phyllis's family maintains about 40 acres, including a 2-acre parcel, which now sits right in the middle of the 130-acre landfill. They refuse to give it up.
This is where we came from. It is important. I can't trace my history any further than Tallapoosa County.
When the state's environmental agency evaluated the landfill plans before granting permits, they weren't required to take any of that history or demographics into account. They did look at technical safety issues, things like liners and how to manage explosive gases. A lawyer who works on environmental justice issues, David Lutter, told me there's nothing in the rules to guarantee dumps don't only end up in poor or minority communities.
I think that what they believe is that their rules and their permits protect everybody equally. But what they're missing is that they don't always protect everybody equally. There are many cases where minorities are impacted much more than whites.
Ron Smith says that's exactly what happened here.
If you look at the map, it's like our county went through and they found out where the black population was and where the black population didn't stand a chance of fighting, and that's where they put the landfill.
As a result, Ron says, the landfill devalued black-owned land and cut the community off from a healthy way of life.
The kids used to walk from one house to another through trails through the woods. Right. That was part of the experience of being here. People used to drink out of the springs here. That was part of the experience of being here.
It was like 3 or 4 pecan trees and then some black walnut trees.
That's Betty Smith, the local school bus driver, who romped through these woods as a kid.
We ate food and stuff. We didn't go back home and get anything to eat. We ate what was around us. Sour grass was there, blackberries. We always had our crab apples and pear trees. You know, we go in people's yard and they'd tell, yeah, y'all get them at them pears or whatever. And that's what we ate during the day.
People in Asher's Barsmith hunted, fished. They were intimately connected to the land. Now they fear it. Betty doesn't even buy local Alabama produce anymore. She looks for Georgia tags. She thinks pollution makes it unsafe.
In my mind, it may not be, but in my mind.
There haven't been any definitive studies looking at pollution or residents' health concerns. In 2003, the dump owner applied for a permit to expand the landfill further. The community took to letter writing.
We are opposed because of the adverse effect that it is creating in our neighborhood.
These people have placed their dreams and their lives in the land. This area has sentimental ties for many of us. It binds us with our kindred in a special way that can only be felt, not spoken.
We've worked hard for our homes. These are acts of terror. We don't want any more.
The state's environmental department once again granted the permits to expand. People in Asher's Barsmith say the state wasn't listening and the landfill owners weren't responsive to concerns. Locals felt the county commissioners didn't care either. None of them live in the neighborhood. The landfill contributes about $500,000 per year to the county's coffers. That's about 4% of the county budget. Though Asher's Barsmith bears the burden of the landfill, locals deal with the stench and traffic, the money is split evenly around the county. By the way, neither the state, the local commissioner, nor the current landfill owner would comment for this story. When I stopped by the landfill hoping to talk to someone, the manager aggressively shooed me off the premises. Eventually, Asher Sparsmith turned to the last resort, the feds.
I wrote a complaint in 2003 to the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, reaching out for help in this regard to try to curtail this expansion.
That's Phyllis Gosa again. Her complaint, alleging the state's permit failed to protect her African-American community, went to the EPA's Office of Civil Rights. And it sat there and sat there and sat there.
EPA has a terrible record of civil rights enforcement.
That's Marion Engelman Lotto, a lawyer who's worked with Phyllis and the others. By the time I started reporting this story, 14 years had passed since Phyllis submitted her complaint. Marion says as a society, we wouldn't stand for that kind of lax civil rights enforcement in any other area.
This is not acceptable, just like it wouldn't be acceptable if we're discriminated in employment or in housing. It's not acceptable to discriminate in the siting of facilities or in the allocation of resources on the environment or in access to open space.
So the community, working with Marion, upped the ante again. They filed a lawsuit, along with four other communities around the U.S., with outstanding complaints, alleging EPA wasn't doing its job investigating or enforcing civil rights. The idea was to resolve the individual complaints, but also to get the EPA to fix its civil rights office, to get it to be more responsive to discrimination grievances. That lawsuit was brought in 2016. Soon after, EPA started closing, one by one, the languishing complaints the lawsuit is built on. At first, Marion saw the movement on the smaller complaints as a good thing, but eventually came to see it as an effort by EPA to get the big lawsuit kicked out of court.
EPA just simply does not have the culture of enforcing civil rights, and it needs to develop the political will to do so.
As I was wrapping up my reporting for this story, EPA suddenly closed the Asher Sparsmith complaint. They found there wasn't enough evidence to say Alabama was unfair to Black communities. Rather than trying to address an injustice, Marion says, the EPA used a technicality to close the complaint. 2 days later, lawyers for the EPA sent a letter asking the court to dismiss the lawsuit. I contacted the EPA. They wouldn't give me an interview. Meanwhile, just this February, the state renewed the landfill's permit to operate. These days, the 130-acre dump takes in trash from the entire state of Alabama and some counties in Georgia. The company owns 400 acres in the area, so there's potential for future growth. When I was in Asher Sparsmith, Betty Smith, the bus driver we met earlier, told me she was the second generation to deal with this landfill.
And, you know, it's a losing battle with something so large, and we losing our heritage. It's to me, it means a lot because this is where I was raised at, you know. 58 years, that's a long time.
She says she doesn't know if the next generation, her grown daughters, should continue the fight.
If the Lord called me on, y'all just bury me and forget about Alabama. Just don't come back. And that's sad. Past years, I've told them, you know, just don't worry about it. Something happened to me. Y'all just go on and say, hey, Alabama was a place that you live, and just go on with your life.
Irina Zhurov reported this story. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Today we're talking about poison. Big wild animals like elk, mule deer, bears are part of what attracts tourists to the Rocky Mountain West, to observe nature in all of its glory and to hunt. It's a big part of the local economy, but in recent months there has been a threat to that income. Dead animals splayed out across recreational areas where people normally hunt.
There is nothing like a giant carcass to create distrust in the quality of wildlife and the local ecosystem. Bree Ripley profiles the prime suspect. It's a plant native to Asia that's a favorite in American backyards.
Landowners love the Japanese yew. The ornamental bush provides a good bit of privacy, and yews can grow up to 18 feet tall. You've probably seen the plant before. It has bright red berries, and during the holidays, florists often shape them into wreaths to hang on doorways. The yew has green, shiny, needle-like leaves, and it smells like Christmas. But as beautiful as the Japanese yew is, it's also deadly. Landscaper Stuart Shea won't plant it anymore.
So, would you say that you're kind of like an enemy of Japanese yew?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I mean, yeah, sure. An informal Japanese yew resistor, maybe?
Stuart is a sustainable landscaper. That is, he doesn't plant anything he considers harmful to the local ecosystem. He says he used to plant yew back in college, but stopped once he learned every part of it was poisonous. In his own backyard, when animals come to visit, everything's safe to eat.
Deer travel along this canal over here to the south, and they definitely, like, they browse through my yard.
Like they're grocery shopping.
Yeah, totally.
In January, Idaho Fish and Game officials were called to investigate a string of suspicious deaths and pointed the finger at Japanese yew. They found the plant killed nearly 3 dozen elk, a herd of 50 pronghorn, also known as antelope, and 2 moose. The problem has reached as far east as Pennsylvania, where yew was the culprit in the killing of a mama black bear and her 3 cubs. A county in southern Idaho considers it such a problem that they issued a ban on the shrub last year. It's now a misdemeanor for landowners to plant or possess any variety of Japanese yew. But here in Billings, Montana, at the nursery down the street from Stewart's house...
We're all out of yew right now.
All out?
Just a minute. There might be one back over here.
They don't seem to be as worried. Garden stores still sell yew. Landowners still buy it. But less than 3 hours west, Dr. Jennifer Ramsey is worried. She's the chief wildlife veterinarian at the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks Lab in Bozeman.
See where all the magic happens.
It's her job to collect evidence of suspicious wildlife deaths by performing necropsies. That's an animal autopsy.
This is our walk-in. This might really stink, but I'll just show you so you know. This is our walk-in cooler. These are animals that I still need to get necropsied this week. So we have an elk calf and an owl that was found dead in someone's yard. And so that, again, that's where the public comes into play. This man had an owl die in his yard. That seemed odd to him. So luckily he brought it in. Now we can look at it and figure out why it died and see whether it was disease-related or not, or toxic. So
she moves to a steel table and begins slicing into the intestine of a fox suspected of dying suddenly from a poisoning. The little guy is bloated and pretty far along in the decay process. His small intestines have turned a bright shade of green, and his liver looks squishy and caramelized, like my grandma's apple butter. As she works, an enormous industrial fan roars from the ceiling to vent the stench of rotting flesh.
You get a grizzly bear in here, and I have people in the building next door complaining to me about the smell. That's how bad it gets.
Jennifer says that wild animals are usually pretty good at avoiding poisonous plants. But just as they've made it through a harsh, often sub-zero Montana winter, their will to survive overrides their instinct to stay away from poison. They nibble at anything, even if they'd normally avoid it.
At that time of year, they're looking for something to sustain themselves. You can imagine that an animal that's in that poor body condition might be willing to ingest something that maybe doesn't taste so good.
Around this time of year, Jennifer starts getting calls from outdoorsy types, people who own huge stretches of property, or the people who hike and play in public parks. They call when they come across a carcass. It's just unusual to find a young, healthy-looking animal dead in the woods.
Yew is one that they ingest that doesn't take very long before they actually are dead.
If you're an animal without a map in the Rocky Mountain West, it's easy to stumble into a private backyard decorated with poisonous yew. Montana is a checkerboard of private and public lands. Especially out in the more desolate areas, Jennifer needs landowners to help her solve mysterious animal deaths.
But the public really can be our eyes and ears and let us know when they see something sick or something dead that just doesn't make sense. And then that gives us a much better chance of getting samples and getting a diagnosis.
Every day, landowners make planting decisions that change the course of an animal life. A winter-worn elk or a curious fox see every plant as a potential meal. For The Pulse, I'm Bree Ripley.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. Today, we're tracking down poison in our environment, our food, and sometimes it's part of medical treatment.
Those drugs are poisons for the cell, and as a result, they have some poisonous characteristics for the rest of the body.
That's oncologist Otis Brawley.
Chemotherapy is a broad term for well over 100 different drugs for cancer, and those drugs get into the cell and do different things, all ending up, hopefully, with the cancer cell dying.
Otis is the chief medical officer of the American Cancer Society, and we talked about how patients are affected by that poison as it hopefully is curing their cancer.
There are some drugs that we use, particularly in breast cancer, that have a 5 to 10 year increased risk of leukemia. There are some drugs, particularly in breast and lung cancer, that can also increase risk of congestive heart failure or weakening of the heart.
What about the nausea? How does that happen?
The nausea can be in two different ways. There's a direct nausea caused by certain types of chemotherapy directly upon that part of the brain. And then there's some people who get trained to expect that nausea, and they actually even have that nausea sometimes when they go to the room to get the chemotherapy before they get the chemotherapy.
Huh, so it becomes a trained response.
That's right. That's right. It is a trained response in that instance, but it is a real response when some people get this drug.
How do you talk to patients about balancing the poison and the treatment? You said chemo is poison cells, but it also has a benefit.
Yeah, everything that we do in life has a benefit risk, and there is a benefit risk ratio that economists can associate with everything. I'm going to drive home this afternoon. That actually involves some risk, but there's also the benefit that I'm very likely to get home safe. Same in medicine. When I'm looking at a cancer patient, I have to look at their particular situation. I have to say, and frequently I will have this conversation with the patient, that I think the odds of benefit from this drug are greater than the risk of harm.
I guess the hope is that cancer treatment will become more and more fine-tuned and more targeted, where the treatment would really only destroy the cancer cell. Do you see that happening anytime soon?
I do believe in my 30 years of practicing the drug combinations that we are giving now are easier to tolerate. Some of them are easier to tolerate because we have drugs to help with the side effects, and some of the newer drugs do have less side effects, but less side effects does not mean no side effects.
A lot of patients have a ritual when they finish chemotherapy. A lot of medical centers even have certain rituals. Some places have a bell that patients can ring. What are some rituals you've seen over the years that people have done to kind of mark the end of their chemotherapy?
Oh, I've seen patients bring in cakes and throw parties for the staff. And I've seen a lot of dancing, a lot of music. One lady I can distinctly remember 15 years ago brought in these little paper things that you blow in and they extend out, and everybody had them and some whistles and things. And so, yes, finishing chemotherapy can be a momentous day for the patients as well as for the health caregivers.
Oncologist Otis Brawley from the American Cancer Society describing how patients celebrate the end of chemotherapy. Rachel Goldberg was looking for her own ritual after going through chemo for breast cancer, something cleansing, and she ended up adapting an ancient Jewish tradition. She had been visiting a ritual bath called a mikvah for years, every month after getting her period. It takes a lot of prep work. You have to make sure nothing gets between your body and the water.
It's always a good opportunity to tidy up your eyebrows and get pretty. I'm just going to use the tweezer because it's been a while. And there's definitely some tweezing situation that has to happen here.
For many years, she thought of mikveh as a religious requirement, something expected in her faith community, but she didn't really feel very connected to it. But after breast cancer, she found new meaning in the mikveh. Abigail Holzman was there with her.
Mikveh Chaim in Washington, D.C. is a little like a spa. There's sparkling marble, and the preparation room has everything Rachel needs to get her body ready for the mikveh waters. Pink razors, tweezers, and a comb floating in blue barbicide.
This is my first time at the mikveh with such short hair.
Rachel's wrapped in a white robe. She's 38, so she's used to the routine. But this place is new to her. And this time, she's bringing a radically changed body to the ritual.
My hair started growing back after my chemo. Up top here is probably, 1 inch long? There's not really any hair to comb, but I'll comb it.
Rachel's normally pretty confident. She's a mother of five, but in this moment, she's unsure.
It's been a while, and the last time I was here was before my chemo. So I feel a little nervous. I don't know why. But I'm happy I came. I've just been through a lot since the last time I've been here. Just gonna get a nail file. My nails are almost like all grown out from the chemo. Like I had problems with my nails. I don't know if you could see.
Rachel thought she might never come back to the mikveh. Women who go through chemo sometimes stop menstruating. And within Rachel's observant community, women who stop menstruating stop mikveh. It's just not done. But Rachel decided to try mikveh again. Her good friend Chaya invited her here, where Chaya works. It's a progressive, open mikveh, where women can come for any reason, even if you no longer get your period. Today, Rachel's here just for herself. Chemotherapy took its toll, and she's hoping the holy waters will help cleanse her spirit.
I feel like it's amazing what the body is capable of. It's really incredible, you know? It just, the body has such a strong will.
On the wall for your robe. Okay. You're all set, and just let yourself back out whenever you're ready.
Thanks. Rachel stands next to the pool, holding her robe tightly. She takes a few nervous steps forward and then back.
I don't have nipples, just so you know. I don't want you to get freaked out. My tumor was too close to the front of my breast, so they couldn't do any nipple preservation. Sometimes they can, and then they can keep your natural, but I don't, so I just have two scars on my chest. It's warm, it's so warm. When you say the bracha, you cross your arms and your legs. This is what I was taught, because you're naked, you know? Baruch Ata Adonai. Elohim Melech HaOlam. Asher Yishev Etzatot Tzibon. Ala Tfila.
Rachel
Rachel dips under the water 3 times, immersing her entire body. Then she climbs out and wraps herself back in the white robe. She plans to keep coming back. Since her period has almost stopped, she'll make her own schedule. Perhaps on her birthday, to mark her children's birthdays, or maybe before her wedding anniversary. After years of obligation, mikveh suddenly feels holy.
I'm really happy I came. I'm Charlie.
Oh, I'll see you. My pleasure.
Very good.
Anytime.
This story was reported by Abigail Holzman. She is a producer with the radio program Interfaith Voices. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott, and we're talking about poison today. And I really wanted to hear from people. Have you ever come in touch with poison? So I asked around on social media, and I got back lots of crazy stories. And many of them were about reactions to prescription drugs, bloated faces, rashes, insane itches. But Eric Asselon had something far worse. He came home from work with a muscle ache in his legs, and then suddenly he couldn't walk or even move, so he sat completely helpless on the steps to his house until his wife came home.
I was rushed to the hospital, and they did a series of tests to discover that my muscles were shredding their fibers, releasing poisonous proteins into my bloodstream, a condition called rhabdomyolysis. The shredded proteins were starting to clog my kidneys, which I was told could shortly lead to kidney failure. They did not know why this was happening. Then one doctor saw in my chart that I had just begun taking the statin medications for elevated cholesterol a few days earlier.
And this doctor recognized what was happening to Eric was a very rare but possible side effect of taking statins. So Eric spent a couple of days in the hospital, and he says it took almost a year for his kidneys to recover. Thank you for sharing that story, Eric. And we always love to hear from you. Best place to get in touch with us is on our Facebook page, WHYY The Pulse. A lot of people are worried about pesticide residue in our food.
My name is Hannah Sassaman. I am the mom of 2 kids, a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old.
Hannah buys mostly organic stuff. She goes to a food co-op, a farmer's market. She even grows some of her own veggies. And she sort of uses a rule of thumb to guide her purchases.
If the pesticide has been put directly onto the vegetable or it's grown directly out of the ground, like spinach, for example, probably I want organic for something like that. And we go through a lot of spinach. Fruits, we generally do organic, but we think bananas are basically fine. We peel them anyway. And so I don't think we get organic bananas. We also are obviously thinking about price. My kids eat a ridiculous amount of food. And so something like blackberries, I'm not going to get 20 boxes of just because they're organic, because they're really expensive to get. So I'm also looking for something like apples, which is considerably cheaper, lasts longer. It's a bunch of different factors that go into the food shopping decisions.
I usually don't buy organic. I can't even really tell you why, but price definitely plays a role. And I think I'm generally more of a, it's probably fine kind of person. The Environmental Protection Agency has to test all of the pesticides used in the U.S. They have to meet certain safety standards, but there are researchers saying that many of the commonly used pesticides still pose a potential health risk for consumers. One of them is biologist Tyrone Hayes at the University of California, Berkeley. He has studied an herbicide called atrazine. It prevents the growth of weeds, and it's often used on corn. And he found that it hurts the hormone system of frogs.
It is an endocrine disruptor that lowers the male hormone testosterone and increases estrogen production. And in male frogs, this results in low sperm count or fertility, an absence of male reproductive behavior, feminization. Some males, genetic males, completely turn into females. And we've also showed that with a mixture of pesticides, there's a negative effects on the stress reaction. So animals have more stress hormone, which lowers their immune function and decreases growth and development.
So these are frog studies, but they have heightened concern about the impact on human health. And Tyrone is especially worried about farm workers.
If you eat one apple, that apple might have a certain amount of pesticide residue on it. But the person that sprayed and that worked in the crops was exposed to a much larger amount of pesticide and exposed to it, you know, before it's been metabolized or starting to break down. So it always amazes me when I drive through Salinas and you see the warning, do not enter pesticide poison signs with the skull and crossbones on the field. And, you know, and then just a few miles down the road, we're supposed to buy that at the market and all of a sudden it's safe.
Tyrone Hayes is a biologist at the University of California, Berkeley, and he says he's concerned that the EPA will be weakened under the Trump administration and be less rigorous in terms of testing and limiting pesticides, which would mean consumers like me might have to study up to see what's really in our food. But those strawberries are so cheap. Coming up, a passionate scientist invites a group of men over for dinner and serves them poison. Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY. CTCA offers genomic testing to help doctors determine treatment options based on patients' personal genetic makeup. Genomic tumor assessment may hold the key to help patients improve quality of life and discover more precise treatment options that were previously not considered. More at cancercenter.com. Cancer Treatment Centers of America. Care that never quits.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. We're tracking down poison on today's show, and here's a line you say thousands of times as a parent. Don't put that in your mouth. What do you do? No, not in your mouth. This is a developmental stage. When little kids explore the world around them, they put stuff in their mouths as a way to learn more about the item. Is this soft? Is it hard? Can I eat it? And each year, more than a million kids come in contact with poisonous stuff like cleaning supplies or cosmetics, pills. So an icon was born, a scowling face, to help panicked parents. Margaret J. Krause has this story.
Mystery Yuck is mean. Mystery Yuck is green.
The green, sort of scary, ugly-looking guy sticking his tongue out and sort of scowling at you.
That's Mr. Yuck. Well, the description is. Dr. Michael Lynch is doing the talking. He's medical director for the Pittsburgh Poison Center. Both the center and the Mr. Yuck stickers grew out of one doctor's quest to keep kids from getting poisoned. In the late 60s and early 70s, Richard Moriarty was training in pediatrics at Pittsburgh's Children's Hospital. He was bothered by the way the hospital handled poison calls.
When the phone rang, whoever was the house officer in the emergency room and answered the phone was suddenly the poison person. And often we didn't really know what the heck we were doing.
Richard wanted to create a standard procedure so whoever took the call would know how to respond. That's when he discovered a few problems. At the time, most poisons were marked with a skull and crossbones or colored in red. Thing is, kids kind of like red. Kool-Aid, lollipops. The hospital team called in a focus group to help create a new symbol.
So we sat down and talked with preschoolers and said, okay, if you got into a poison, what would happen? And the recurring thoughts were, well, you die, you get sick, or your mother would yell at you.
A graphic artist created a bunch of designs in a range of colors and put them back in front of the preschoolers.
One of the kids said, that looks yucky. So we thought, okay, we got a symbol, we got a name, let's go with it.
Every Mr. Yuck sticker is printed with the number of the National Poison Control Hotline, as well as the nearest center, so people know where to call for help.
Pittsburgh Poison Center, how can I help you?
Fewer kids are dying from medicine or household cleaners, but they're still the ones most likely to be poisoned. Kids under the age of 6 made up nearly half of poison incidents in 2015. But most don't require a trip to the emergency room these days. Lots of parents start by calling the 24-hour hotline to get information. And peace of mind. For The Pulse, I'm Margaret J. Krause.
Margaret is a reporter for WESA in Pittsburgh. There's no need to put a Mr. Yuck sticker on any of the food we buy in the grocery store, ketchup bottles, a jar of jelly, maybe peanut butter. And we have one man to thank for that, a chemist who spent his entire career working to make America's food supply safe. He relied on some pretty unusual or perhaps ruthless methods to get his message across. Shruti Pinnamaneni brings us his story.
Picture this. It's the winter of 1902. We're in Washington, D.C., in the basement of a government building. 12 young men, boys really, are sitting down to dinner. Their suits are neatly pressed and their mustaches are stiff with wax. Waiters are serving them courses like chipped beef, turnips, and celery on toast. But there's a problem with all this fancy food. It's been spiked with an unidentified poison. The men know this, but they go ahead and eat everything on their plates. The newspapers have a name for these guys. They are the Poison Squad. This ritual poisoning is actually a government project. Congress has signed off on it, and it will go on like this for years. The mastermind behind this experiment, he's standing at the head of the table, watching his boys eat. His name is Harvey Washington Wiley.
That's an early picture of him. Look at the homespun jacket and his derby hat.
Suzanne Junot is a historian at the Food and Drug Administration.
Wiley was born in 1844 in Indiana on a farm, and he decided fairly early, I think, that he didn't want to be a farmer.
Instead, Wiley went to a college nearby, bringing all his provisions from home. He writes in his biography,
"We brought potatoes, cornmeal, and sorghum molasses. We also brought butter from home and made arrangements with a German woman to bake our flour into bread."
But this intimate connection with food, knowing what was in your bread and your butter, this was all about to change by the 1900s.
50% of all Americans now lived in cities.
That's Melanie Warner. She wrote a book about processed foods called Pandora's Lunchbox.
They had moved off the farm, so they had to rely on other people that they didn't know, strangers, companies, to produce their food.
This food was all coming from far away places. There were tins of bright green peas or cans of gooey pink meat. The labels back then didn't always have a list of ingredients, so if you were staring at one of these cans trying to figure out what was in it, you could only guess. By this point, Wiley was 37 years old. He was working as state chemist of Indiana. He starts using this thing called a polariscope, which is basically a microscope that uses a special light source. He points his lens at this golden liquid from a tin labeled Pure Maple Syrup of Vermont and sees that
maple syrup has been displaced by glucose.
Cheap glucose from corn, nothing like the stuff that oozes out of a maple tree. In a can of green peas, he finds
sulfate of copper to give them a vivid green color.
Even pumpkin pie wasn't pumpkin pie anymore, but
mashed turnip, colored yellow, with annatto.
Now, keep in mind there were no laws against this at the time, so food companies could do pretty much anything they wanted.
They would take rotting meat and rotting eggs and doctor them up with chemical preservatives, passing them off as fresh meat.
So people were eating this rotten meat, except they didn't know that it was rotten or that it had been treated with borax, this white powder that we nowadays use to clean clothes or kill ants. They also didn't know that the milk they were drinking had been mixed in with formaldehyde. Dairy companies did that to keep old milk from going sour. By now, Wiley had worked his way up into a pretty powerful position. He was chief chemist of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He had a hunch that these food chemicals were harmful, deadly even. But how could he prove it? The solution was obvious.
Fortunately, the Department of Agriculture is richly provided with subjects for experiments, if only their consent be obtained.
So Wiley recruited a dozen clerks and low-level employees. In exchange for free room and board, they signed a pledge that they will not hold the government responsible for any illness or accident, including death. And in December 1902, the experiments began. The men lived and ate in the Bureau of Chemistry. A chef prepared the meals.
Roast lamb, 66 grams, potatoes.
And Wiley would spike these meals.
Peas, 50 grams.
With increasing doses of borax.
I gather peaches were used as dessert, canned peaches, of course.
Everyone had to submit all their bodily fluids, their stool samples, urine samples, pretty much daily.
Wiley even built a special fecal drying machine.
to analyze the piles of evidence he was collecting.
With number 5, the constipation has given way to looseness of the bowels. 4 evacuations taking place during the day.
When they got too sick to continue the work, he would take them off the experiments and give them what he called clean food.
Number 5 is quite ill with a sick headache and diarrhea. No borax is administered on April 27th.
Over the course of 5 years, about 50 men served on the squad. Group by group, they ate borax, formaldehyde, salicylic acid, sulfuric acid, sodium benzoate, potassium nitrate. They lived with sharp stomach cramps, fevers, nausea. Several men dropped out midway, and one man never recovered and died months later in his mother's home.
An enterprising reporter got wind that this was happening in the Bureau of Agriculture, and he started interviewing the chef through a basement window. And once he wrote the story, he actually gave them the name the Poison Squad.
The public couldn't get enough. The news stories about the squad bounced between outrageous and outraged. There were headlines like Poison Eater Dead or Salicylic Acid Hurts. And after years of this, the stories paid off. Wiley finally got what he wanted, a food law, a big one.
How does a general feel who wins a great battle and brings a final end to hostilities? I presume I felt that way on the last day of June, 1906.
That's the day that Congress passed the Pure Food and Drug Act. This law would lay the grounds for what would eventually become the FDA. Now, for the first time, food companies could be fined if they lied on their labels, and states could ban specific chemicals from food, which many did. Wiley resigned from his government job in 1912, but he didn't stop fighting for this ideal of pure food. He spent his remaining years writing for the magazine Good Housekeeping, where he became famous for his seal of approval and his diatribes against tobacco and Coca-Cola and bleached white flour and high-fructose corn syrup and saccharin and gelatin and food dyes.
I've always stood for food that is food.
I'm Shruti Pindamaneni.
This story was part of the PRX STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and additional editing and sound design by Brendan Baker. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, Elizabeth Fiedler, and Alan Yu. I was asking people online this week about their poison stories, and I heard some pretty wild tales about poisoned pets, adverse drug reactions, and I really wanted to share this one with you. It was sent to me by Nicole Yates. She lives in Philadelphia, and she was basically poisoned while visiting her grandmother, her Bachi, she calls her. And Bachi had just gotten home after being in the hospital for a long time, so Nicole decided to stop by.
Offhandedly, she said if I was hungry, there was a half hoagie in the fridge if I wanted it, and there it was, wrapped tightly in plastic wrap, a little ham and cheese hoagie, no lettuce or nothing. I ate it and then went to a video shoot, and I threw up in Washington Square Park, took an Uber back to my friend's house to get my car, and I threw up in the street. It gets a little bit fuzzy after that. Someone drove me to Jefferson, called my mom, I sat there for 6 hours, both ends, woof, running. They finally got me to a room, treated me for dehydration, and then went home. It was then my mom told me my Bachi meant a different sandwich, not the one that I ate. The one I ate was from right before she went in the hospital, 3 months before.
Don't ever miss a moment of The Pulse. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We had help producing this week's show from Joel Wolfram and Alex Stern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager is our associate producer. Tanya English is our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Maiken Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Neurosciences. At Penn Neurosciences, brain and spine specialists work together to help people break through the darkness of their disease. From delivering clinical research to finding new approaches to treat MS and epilepsy to developing advanced procedures for brain and spine disorders, the Penn Neurosciences team cares for each patient and their individual needs. More information is available at penmedicine.org/neuro.